Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. This hour, Jimmy Akin with us for Ask Me Anything hour. I was going to say a bonus Ask Me Anything hour, but we've been doing a lot of Ask Me Anything hour. So I don't know when we're into the bonus. I'm not sure. But Jimmy's here. If you've got a question, dial now because there's three lines open. 888-318-7884. The number Ask Me Anything is for anyone. If you are Catholic, you're welcome. If you're not Catholic, you're welcome. And whatever your question is, you are welcome. Can I make you feel more welcome? If I could, I would. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. The author of The Bible is a Catholic Book and Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and also the proprietor of two podcasts now, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and the Jimmy Akin Podcast. Hi, Jimmy Akin.
Yeah. Howdy, Cy Kellett.
You busy enough?
Well, I've been a little too busy lately, but things are evening out a little bit.
Oh, all right. And so let me just ask you where people can get the Jimmy Akin podcast, because I want to listen to you a few times before I start trying to do it, because then I'll get it right.
Well, right now it's at my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/Jimmy Akin. It's also going to be appearing on all the standard podcast apps, you know, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, all those things. Last I checked, it wasn't yet on those, but they're working on that. But you can get it right now at youtube.com/Jimmy Akin. And it's the second episode just came out today. I'm going to have at least one episode coming out a week on Mondays, maybe more, but at least one on Mondays. And this week's is on, if God knows the future, how can we have free will? And The answer is simpler than you might think, but a lot of folks wonder about that. So that's what we're talking about this time.
Check it out. Exactly where Jimmy mentioned, we'll talk a little bit as we go about Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, because a new episode drops each Friday. As of now, still three lines open. So this is a perfect time. It's very hard to get on the line when Jimmy's here. So this is a good time to get your call in. Now two lines open, 888-318-7884. We'll start with John in Minnesota watching on YouTube. Hello, John. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. Hey, thanks for taking the call. And forgive me if you've answered this question before, but my question is regarding marriage, the sacrament of marriage. And have you seen the movie Castaway, 20 years old or so, with Tom Hanks?
I'm aware of the movie, but I have not seen it. I just know that he talks to a beach ball or something.
Right. Nice summary.
All right. So, the quick and dirty is, let's just say a scenario. Okay, a young Catholic couple, they get married, totally valid Catholic marriage, right? No funny business or no room for annulment or anything. He goes on a trip. His plane goes down in the ocean, presumed dead. One in a million, though, he survives, right? He's standing on this island, and then years go by. So she's a young woman. The wife wasn't. The only thing I could get online as an answer to this is that if a body's not present, she has to get permission from her bishop to get remarried. But let's say she falls in love, gets that permission, remarries, has some children, and then, you know, like I said, years go by, okay, the original husband comes back into the picture. What happens? And practically, what happens? And then also theologically, what was going on with her quote-unquote new marriage, and, you know, questions about sin, and it was grace present when they consummated that, you know? So that's kind of my question.
Okay, so there's a whole bunch of issues there, but I'll deal with them expeditiously. So part of, obviously, it's going to be, assuming it's the new marriage is a happy one, it's going to be traumatic when husband number one shows up. But in terms of what happens practically, one of two things. Now, you said, as you stipulated as part of the question, that there are no grounds for an annulment. In reality, if the woman is happy with her new husband, it's possible that she could pursue an annulment just to take a look at that first marriage and see if she was actually bound to husband number one or not. That would be a little unusual, but we're already dealing with, since they would be legally married already in the eyes of civil law, but it's possible that that could happen. On the other hand, suppose they look at it and say, yeah, we don't see any grounds for annulment here. Well, that means she's still bound to her first husband. And so she can't legitimately be having conjugal relations with husband number two. She could hypothetically divorce husband number two and resume life, married life with husband number one, or she could live with husband number two as brother and sister. In terms of what happened in terms of sin and grace and so forth, well, since she believed in good conscience that husband number one was dead, and since husband number two believed in good conscience that husband number one was dead, they would have been objectively committing adultery when they had conjugal relations, but they would not be held accountable for that by God because they didn't know that that was the moral character of the act that they were performing. So it would have been objectively sinful, but they wouldn't have been culpable for that sin. And therefore, grace would continue to flow in their lives when they received the sacraments and things like that. In terms of the children that she had with husband number two, those children are not really affected by this. People might wonder, are they legitimate? And the truth is, legitimacy is just a legal category. Even if you're illegitimate, that doesn't affect your status with God. You know, even if kids are born deliberately illegitimate by their parents, that doesn't put a stain on the child. You know, just because your parents messed up, that doesn't mean you've got a problem with God. Those kids are just fine as they are spiritually. And it turns out in this situation, they would also be legitimate in terms of the law, because what the law provides is that children will be legitimate if they're born to an invalid union, as long as at least one of the parties believed the union was valid. And so since both the wife and husband number two thought this was a valid union, then the children would be reckoned as legally legitimate.
John, I hope that got to everything that you wanted to get to. An elaborate set of questions to start with. Thank you for starting us off, John. Jimmy, before we go to the break, maybe you could just tell me what's dropping this week on Friday on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Well, last Friday we had part two of our look at the Zodiac Killer, and this Friday we're looking at another mystery, but fortunately no one dies this time. It's called the Toynbee Tiles. A number back in the 1990s, a gentleman in Philadelphia started noticing these strange tiles in the middle of public streets, and they said things like Toynbee idea, as in Kubrick's 2001 movie, Resurrect Dead on Planet Jupiter, among other things. And it turned out there were hundreds of these tiles in all kinds of cities across the U.S. and even in some other countries. And so he went on a hunt to try to crack the mystery of the Toynbee tiles. And we're going to be telling you all about what he found.
All right, check it out on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, mysterious.fm. Check it out on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. That brings us to the break. And all the lines are full, so lots more calls to come. It's Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Wings is a weekly newsletter that's packed with program information, features, and updates of all that's going on at EWTN. To sign up, go to EWTN.com, click subscribe, enter your name and email address, and you'll start getting your wings every week. Get your wings today. It's the weekly newsletter from EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Ask Me Anything, Jimmy Akin, our guest. And up next is Marie in Houston, Texas, listening on our app, the Catholic Answers Live app. Marie, thanks for downloading it onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you. Hi, Jimmy Akin. I am really confused about which direction to use as my voting choice. I heard the Holy Father's response and to, both candidates. And he said, well, the person that asked him the question said, one of them is not so nice to migrants and the other one is not so nice to unborn babies. And then the Holy Father went on to say that, well, you got to choose the lesser of the two evils. Killing babies is worse. Of course, the Bible also says take care of the widows and the orphans and the foreigners. And then I'm talking to I have a friend who's going to vote for Harris, and she said, well, she's not for abortion. It's just that she wants women to have a choice.
And okay, so Marie, I need to stop you. Marie, I need to stop you for a second. I never talk candidates or parties. So if you ask me a question that's in the form of the principles that are involved, I can answer it. But I'm not gonna answer a question that names candidates or names political parties. So I'll talk principle, but not individuals.
Okay, let me ask you then the principle. I know that God gives us a free will, and so my friend says that, government limiting women's choice is wrong, and in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, okay, God wants people to have a free will, and then I'm thinking, okay, the Bible also says be kind to the foreigners and people that need help. So I am not sure which is the most important.
Why don't I take a swing at it and we'll see if it helps. So the first thing I'd mention is your friend's argument that women should have a right to choose to kill children is nonsense. That would justify killing anybody. God does give us a free will, but that doesn't mean society should allow homicide. And if we have homicide laws to protect the lives of born people, we need to have homicide laws to protect the lives of unborn people. So we shouldn't be killing anybody, born or unborn. That's a specious argument. Your friend is just, her reason is fundamentally flawed on this point. In terms of the issues of immigration and abortion, a standard Catholic moral theology approach would be to distinguish between two issues. The first issue is which is denying an immigrant access to a territory they want to enter versus killing somebody, which is worse. Well, people have a right to life. They don't actually have a right to immigrate. It's being generous of the state to allow immigrants in, and there's a limit to how many immigrants a state can reasonably allow in. That's something Pope Francis himself has acknowledged on 60 Minutes, that, the church's teaching on immigration is not just fling the borders wide open and let everyone in the world come in. So if you're comparing the issue of letting people or denying someone entry into a particular territory versus killing that person, killing a person is obviously worse. The right to life is an absolute right. And unless you forfeit it by, say, murdering somebody. But the right to life is much more fundamental than a right to migrate, which isn't really a right at all. So the issue of abortion considered in the abstract vastly outweighs the issue of immigration considered in the abstract. But then there's a second issue that has to be thought through. which is, what are the practical effects in the current political environment going to be of voting one way or another? Now, before Roe v. Wade was abolished, in America, we had a fundamental block on the ability to do very much regarding abortion. There was no way that we could make significant progress on abortion. I mean, we could nibble around the edges a little bit, but we couldn't really deal with the issue head on as long as Roe v. Wade was there. Now that Roe v. Wade has fallen, the situation has changed, and so consequently, the issue has at this point devolved on the individual states. And so now we have a state-by-state education battle to educate people on the need to have pro-life laws, and a state-by-state legislative battle to try to improve the legal protections for unborn people. What that means, if you're asking about the presidential race, is the role of the president, at least at the moment, is diminished. And so you have to think a little more hypothetically about, well, what will happen depending on what candidate gets into office on the abortion issue. Will a particular presidential candidate support some form of abortion, or will they try to take it out of the hands of the states by creating a national law or a constitutional amendment or something like that? And you got to think about, what impact is the president going to realistically have on abortion going forward? And then factor that in as part of your calculation. When it comes to immigration, you got to think about that too. How many immigrants can the U.S. have come in reasonably? What requirements, and this is something the Catechism talks about, should they be subject to? And would it in fact be better to, rather than bringing them into the U.S., would it be better to help fix their own countries so that they don't want to leave? You know, to my mind, it's better to fix where people came from so that they're happy where they are and don't need to migrate. I know I'd much rather be able to stay where I am in my own home than have to migrate somewhere else. So immigration is a much more complex issue, and you need to think about the impacts on the immigrants, on people back in their home countries, and on people here in the U.S. And you need to factor all that into your calculation. Then there are other pressing issues, because even though we're not currently in World War III, we have had nuclear saber rattling from Vladimir Putin. And hypothetically, we could get into a major war in the next presidency. Hypothetically, it could be a nuclear war, which would kill loads of people, and therefore could kill loads of people. And therefore, you need to think about, okay, that issue too, because that's another life issue. And say, okay, which candidate do I think would be better at preserving life overall? Not just on abortion, but on other issues too, like nuclear war. And from out of all that, you got to make a decision. One thing I liked about what Pope Francis said, and by the way, he didn't name the candidates, but he said, choose the lesser of two evils. You know, unfortunately, there are no perfect candidates that we can pick. And it was nice to have a reminder from the pontiff that we are not responsible for every bad thing a candidate does. We need to do what we can do, which means using our vote to promote the most good and avoid the most evil. But we shouldn't be holding candidates to if you're not absolutely pristine on Catholic doctrine, I cannot vote for you. That will only allow the forces of evil to win. So make your best determination and vote accordingly.
Marie, thank you very much. I hope that was helpful. It's certainly timely, given the time of and season we are in here in the U.S. But on we go. Lines full. We'll go to Daniel in Dallas, Texas, watching on YouTube. Daniel, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. So I know the distinction between material and formal heresy, but my question is about espousing heresy through a canonical delict, meaning you're accused through a formal legal trial, notoriety in law, or notoriety in fact, meaning you can become a heretic before being legally pronounced. So those two distinctions, my question is about Pope Francis or any of the bishops. So when Pope Francis made a comment about making Coptic martyrs as saints, I know he never officially taught it, but he talked about, even though the church teaches that there are no martyrs who are outside of the church, or when Joe Biden said in an interview that the Holy Father said he can continue receiving communion despite his public endorsement of abortion.
Daniel, I'm not sure what you're asking here.
Sorry. Yeah. Does this mean that the church, does this mean that Pope Francis, even though he hasn't officially taught heresy, does this mean that if he believes these things, that he could be considered a heretic by notoriety in fact?
No. And none of the things you mentioned are even close to being heresy. People, especially online, have a dramatically inaccurate understanding of what heresy is that is vastly overexpanded and from what the actual crime is. In order to commit heresy in any form, what you have to do is teach something that is contrary to an infallibly defined dogma. That is, a dogma is something that the church has infallibly defined to be divinely revealed, not just to be true, but to be divinely revealed. And in neither of the cases did you mention, is there a dogma in question? The church acknowledges that that non-Catholics can be saved if they're not members of the Catholic Church through no fault of their own. And therefore, these Coptic individuals could be in heaven. They could be saints. And now, actually, he didn't speak of proclaiming them saints, but including them in a martyrology to commemorate them, which is not the same thing. But even if he wanted to infallibly define that they were saints, or attempt to, even if he wanted to canonize them, that would mean that according to this canonization, they're in heaven, and that is not impossible. So we are not dealing with a heresy here. In terms of someone receiving communion who shouldn't, the church's law presently allows people to receive communion who shouldn't. It's in the first place, it's generally up to the individual to make a determination of are they in mortal sin or not. And some people, frankly, are in mortal sin, but that's not publicly known, and they go ahead and receive, and the church allows that. Also, a priest can be in a position to where he knows the person is in mortal sin. That person may have come to him right before Mass and confessed to him and gave an invalid confession, and the priest denied them absolution. But because of the seal of confession, the priest cannot, in that circumstance, deny them communion. It is simply not a dogma that a person who is in a state of mortal sin may not receive communion under any circumstances. They should not receive under any circumstances, but it is not an infallibly defined teaching of the church that it is impossible for them to receive. And that actually goes all the way back to the New Testament in 1 Corinthians, where St. Paul is warning the Corinthians. He's saying, listen, some of you are not receiving worthily, and you shouldn't, but he nevertheless is not putting the responsibility on each priest to make that determination. And certainly priests are not required to violate the seal. So even if an individual was told by the Pope, and that's a big if because this was a private conversation, and politicians, one truth about politicians is they all tell falsehoods. They're all liars. So even if a politician was told something about it's okay for you to go ahead and receive communion, that's not a denial of a dogma. That's a practical matter. It is not a matter of teaching, and it doesn't contradict the teaching that if someone is in mortal sin, then they should not receive communion. Furthermore, you can have people who support objectively evil policies who may themselves be in good conscience because they can have defective consciences and not realize the moral character of their act. So in no case that you mentioned, do we have anything like a heresy on the table? In order for someone to commit the canonical crime or delict of heresy, they need to, after baptism, obstinately, which requires a canonical warning typically, refuse to believe a dogma, and that refusal to believe a dogma must be publicly manifested. If nobody perceives it, they haven't committed the crime of heresy. And so that's what's required. And I hope that helps you out with your question.
Daniel, thank you for the call. Lots more calls to come. As a matter of fact, every single line full at the moment. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Jimmy, author of many things, including The Bible is a Catholic Book and A Daily Defense, and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, also the proprietor of the new podcast, the Jimmy Akin Podcast. And soon to be here with us in California for the big conference that's coming up. If you'd like to get 30% off right now at shop.catholic.com, it's Shield Week. Just use the promo code St. Michael, just ST Michael, when you check out and receive 30% off on your order. Right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Deepen your connection to the Church's holy days and seasons while you draw on the wisdom of the Church Fathers. Feasts of Our Fathers, the new book from Mike Aquilina and Adam Lucas, is a treasury of history, prayers, insights, and lessons that will bring you closer to the earliest of Catholic traditions. Take your prayer life and your solidarity with the Church, past and present, to a new level. Order your copy of Feasts of Our Fathers today at shop.catholic.com.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that, but he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs, but you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it's Ask Me Anything, and every single line full. Off to Carrie in Utah now. Carrie, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, yes, thank you. Several years ago, I was visiting Italy, and we did a Vatican tour, and which was all great, but my point is, in the gift shop, I bought a rosary. At the Vatican gift shop, and in where Mary would be, the medallion of Mary, there is a skull, and it looks like almost like a crossbone underneath. And I didn't notice it when I bought it, but I was rather shocked, you know, when I took it out of the little box that, you know, they put it in with the clear lid. And I got it out, and I was like, what is this? I didn't notice it, and I was wondering if you had any explanation for what that means.
Yeah, so that's really cool. You got a pirate rosary. And so what you need to do is, after each Hail Mary, you know, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. After each Hail Mary, you need to say, "Arr!" Okay, and that's all you need to do, and you'll be saying the pirate rosary. How does that sound?
I don't think that's right.
I don't think it's right either. I think you are exactly right, Carrie. That is an unacceptable answer.
That is not right. So, okay, here's the real story. The skull and crossbones, that should be what you're looking at. And the skull and crossbones is what's known as a memento mori. Memento mori is a phrase that means remember death. And so Catholics down through the centuries have provided themselves with various reminders of the fact that one day we're all going to die and we're going to stand before, you know, the judgment seat of God, and we need to be prepared for that. And so essentially the function of the skull and crossbones on this rosary is it's to remind us that that's going to happen one day. So it's a memento mori. It may also be connected with Adam, because if you look at some paintings of the crucifixion, for example, there will be a skull and crossbones at the foot of the cross. And the idea is that's Adam's skull and bones. And this shows the triumph of Christ's victory over death, including the death that comes to us because of Adam's sin. And so I'd have to look at the rosary to see, you know, or read about it to see if it's specifically envisioning this as being Adam's skull and bones. But it could be, because the rosary does involve celebrating the mysteries of Christ's life, death, and resurrection, and thus his triumph over sin and death.
Okay. Thank
but
you.
How you.
I just.
Yeah, no problem.
Ahead.
But. You know, how you interpret it, because we put meaning in symbols. If you want to interpret it as a pirate rosary, you could do that. I'm just saying.
No, not a big fan of pirates, but
okay.
I just wanted to, I don't know, I just was really shocked to see that, and I never heard of it, and I didn't know if I was, like, cursed or something, or...
No, they're not going to be selling cursed rosaries in the Vatican.
I didn't think so, but, you know, with God, anything is possible. So I didn't know if, like, this was a sign or something. Like, but thank you for your explanation.
No problem.
I appreciate it.
Carrie, thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you for the call.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Let's go to Greenville, Texas. Rick is listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network in Greenville, Texas. Welcome, Rick. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I believe it was a previous guest that spoke about Mary being an ever virgin, and I think it was Matthew 1:25 that said he did not know, Joseph did not know her until she had her firstborn.
Yes.
Yep.
Or until she had Jesus. Can you explain more about that? Because I guess I'm Catholic, but the Protestants say, oh, no, at that, when he knew her, then she's no longer a virgin.
Okay, well, so I didn't hear what the previous guest said, so I don't know exactly what they said and what they didn't say, but I can give you a basic answer. So the basic answer is the term until, both in Greek, which is the language we have Matthew in, and in English, does not imply a reversal of circumstance. So sometimes the word until means this thing continued up until this point, period. And it doesn't say or imply anything about what happened afterwards. In other cases, it implies it means that this thing happened up to this point, and then there was a reversal of circumstance. So the word until is ambiguous. It can be either one. It can imply that there was a change, or it cannot imply that there was a change. So the word itself is not going to answer that question for you. To give you just a couple of examples, in the Greek Septuagint, which is the Greek version of the Old Testament, it talks about how David's wife, Michal, because she scorned David's attempt to honor the Lord, it says she had no children until the day she died. And it, you know, it uses the same Greek phrase, a Greek, you know, term there. And obviously David's wife, Michael, didn't start having children after she died. So this is a clear case where it means she didn't have children up to the day she died. And there's no reversal of circumstance after that. So it's real clear. And I just said all that in English. And it's natural. If I say she didn't have any children till the day she died, you would understand what I meant. So this is true of the English word until also. There are a variety of different passages like that that show this effect in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. St. Jerome had a discussion of this. He had a kind of controversy with a guy named Helvidius, who was denying Mary's perpetual virginity, and he pointed all this out about the Greek usage. I've got a copy of what he wrote on my website, jimmyakin.com, in the file library. If you go to jimmyakin.com and you go into the file library and you go to the section on Mary and then you look for Jerome against Helvidius, you can read Jerome's discussion of this for yourself. So given that the word is, and it's actually a two-word phrase in Greek, but given that the term is ambiguous and does not tell us by itself whether or not there's a reversal of circumstance, you have to look at context. What else do we know about Mary and her life? And at that point, all of the standard arguments in favor of Mary's perpetual virginity come into the picture. Like in Luke, where she says, I know not man, so how am I going to get pregnant? Well, obviously, she knew the facts of life, and if she was planning a normal sexual marriage, she would know how she's going to get pregnant. Similarly, in John 19, when Jesus is crucified, he entrusts the care of Mary to the beloved disciple, which would make absolutely no sense if she had other children, because it should be them who care for her. And then we have early Christian documents like the second century infancy gospel of James, also known as the Proto-Evangelium of James, which makes it real clear that, you know, there were Christians at this time who, yeah, even this early, believed she remained perpetually a virgin. So all of the regular evidence that we have for Mary's perpetual virginity supplies the context to figure out, does until in Matthew 1:25 imply reversal of circumstance or not? And all this other evidence implies that it doesn't.
Thanks, Rick. I'm going to leave it there and keep getting calls on with Jimmy. There are lines open. Lines have opened up all of a sudden. 888-318-7884. It's Ask Me Anything. You're welcome to ask Jimmy whatever you'd like. Mark is in St. Louis, Missouri, watching on YouTube. Mark, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy. In your debate with James White, you talked about Sola Fide and Pope Benedict. Mm-hmm. You just talk more about that, or...
Okay. Well, if you're asking, so back in 2008, when Pope Benedict was given a series of audiences on St. Paul, in one of the audiences, he talked about how Luther's formula, justification by faith alone, is true, as long as you're not excluding from that faith the concept of love, or, you know, supernatural love, charity. And so, as St. Paul himself says in Galatians 5, in Christ, neither circumcision nor uncircumcision counts for anything. What counts is faith working through love. And for people who follow this issue closely, this is not a surprise. This has always been the Catholic understanding of things. Now, because of the Protestant Reformation and their extensive use of the formula by faith alone, people divvied up into tribes and started treating that as a sine qua non of Protestantism. And if you use that phrase, you must disagree with Catholic teaching. And they frankly misrepresented what the church teaches. But when you study the matter, and I have a whole book about this called The Drama of Salvation, where I talk about this. I also have a 20 Answers booklet called 20 Answers, Faith and Works, where I talk about this. But the formula faith alone is not alien to Catholic teaching. In fact, it has been used by Catholic thinkers down through the ages, including people like St. Thomas Aquinas, who's a doctor of the church. And when the Council of Trent did was not reject the formula faith alone, What it did was reject a misunderstanding of the formula faith alone. It infallibly defined that what it rejected infallibly was saying that man is justified by faith alone if you mean that all you need is intellectual faith. And so if you mean all you need to do is just believe Christian teachings and you have a purely intellectual faith, that'll justify you. Well, no, it won't. And so that's, you know, the church's position. But most Protestants don't believe that either. They think you need a more robust faith than mere intellectual belief. So what else do you need? What needs to be part of it? Well, one view that you have in some Protestant circles is you need more than intellectual faith. You need what they call fiducial faith. Fiducia means trust. And so you need to, in addition to have intellectual belief in the gospel, you need to trust God for your salvation. And they'll say that that's what saves you. The problem is St. Paul denies that in 1 Corinthians 13, where he's talking about the virtue of love. And he says, look, even if I had faith strong enough to move mountains, and you really got to trust God pretty strongly. So this is clearly fiducial faith we're talking about in order to move mountains. But if I didn't have love, it wouldn't benefit me at all. And so fiducial faith is not the right kind of faith either. The right kind of faith, as Paul makes clear in 1 Corinthians 13 and in Galatians 5, is faith that incorporates love. Because he says love believes all things and hopes all things. So if you have supernatural love or charity, that incorporates faith and it incorporates trust or hope. And so you have all three theological virtues. And then that's what he says counts in Christ in Galatians 5. So yeah, if you have faith working through love, you are in a state of grace. Now that doesn't deny the role of the sacraments or anything like that, because if you have supernatural love of God, you're going to want to do what God says. And God says, go get baptized. So you're going to go get baptized and he'll give you his grace through the baptism. But if you have faith working through love, then you are in a state of grace. You are in a state of justification.
Mark, thank you. That does bring us to the break. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything. More calls to come. We can get you in the queue if you want to dial now, because we have a couple lines open. 888-318-7884.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
You know, I have never seen women who want to be equal absolutely degrading themselves. And yet the media degrades your nature, your beauty as a woman, your goodness. Let us pray. At some point, our dear Lord touches their hearts.
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and it's an Ask Me Anything. We'll go to Lafayette, Louisiana now, where Adam is listening on 90.5 FM. Adam, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy. Honored to talk to you. I was at Mass a while back, and the priest was encouraging everybody at the church who was present to go to communion, even if they hadn't been in a while, because he believed that it was important for everybody to receive our Lord. And then he said if anybody wasn't worthy to just make like an act of contrition in their heart and then to seek confession afterwards, but still encouraged everyone that was there to go to communion. And since then, we have actually found another parish just because that rubbed me the wrong way. And I'm wondering if I'm overreacting or if that was erroneous advice.
It was erroneous advice. It is possible in limited circumstances for individuals to make an act of perfect contrition with the intention of going to confession later and then receiving communion. But for the laity to do that, there have to be grave circumstances. Like, you know, this is, you're not going to be able to receive for another month if you don't do this. Or you're in danger of dying, or, you know, something like that. A priest does not have the authorization to just make the determination, oh, I think everyone needs to go to communion and make an act of contrition. That is way beyond what he has the ability to authorize. So that was erroneous advice. And frankly, I would, if you know who the priest is, I would report that to the bishop, because that's serious pastoral malpractice.
Okay, thank you.
All right. No problem. Adam, thank you very much. Well, I'm going to tell you what, calls keep dropping, so I'm going to say go ahead and call if you've got a question. 888-318-7884 is the number. It's Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin. I am going to go to line five. Let's go to Michael in Omaha, Nebraska. Michael, glad you called. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, I was a fallen away Catholic, and when I went through reconciliation about 23 years ago, the first priest through our class did not give me absolution and basically said, you know, I should talk to a psychologist, or because I had 30 years worth of sins, and I was kind of, I just kind of broke down. And I went back to my parish and met my priest there, and he did give me absolution. So I went through with the communion and everything and that. So I'm just wondering, is there any, I'm not sure what to ask, but am I absolved or?
Well, if the second priest absolved you, then yeah, you're absolved.
Okay. I mean, it just kind of threw me when I went through the 6 months of classes, and then this one priest, just a, and he was kind of a young priest, but probably more of a ideological person. But and since then, when we've had like the communal absolutions, like during the holiday season, Lent and Advent and that, that he has given me absolution then, but I was just curious on this first time, does that have any weight to it since my parish priest went ahead and gave me absolution, or?
Yeah, so just to reiterate, if you've been absolved, then you've been absolved. Don't worry about it beyond that. It doesn't matter what some guy did the first time. If you are subsequently absolved, then you are absolved. So put your mind at rest and do not worry about it. I do want to clarify one thing, though. When you said communal reconciliation, I assume you're talking about penance services where you have one or more priests and people go to them for individual confession and get absolved. Assuming that's what you mean, well, then those are just additional cases where you got absolved. But you don't need to worry about this. If you've been absolved, then you've been absolved. It's a simple tautology.
Michael, thank you very much for the call. I do hope that that was helpful to you. Now, all of a sudden, everybody's on the line. Let's go to San Antonio, Texas. Renee in San Antonio.
Wait, before they drop.
Go ahead. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy, Renee.
Hey, all right. Appreciate y'all taking my call. So this is, my question is, I guess, purgatory, you have like this old idea of like, you know, where you could do things for a number of days, and now we kind of have a different, maybe not a different, but just like a different understanding where it's more of just kind of like a purification and it's sort of not necessarily temporal or a place or anything like that. Can we still hold to that traditional, more ancient view of like, or I guess, I don't even know if it is really that a traditional view, but that older view of like it being a place with those days and things like that? I don't know if
okay,
that makes sense.
So I assume, hang on, I assume the days you're talking about are the ones that used to be printed on indulgences. So it would say, like, this is a 14-day indulgence or this is a 500-day indulgence. And those are gone. Those are no longer part of church practice. The reason they're gone is because people misunderstood what they were. They were never saying, oh, you'll get out of purgatory 14 days earlier, or you'll get out of purgatory 500 days earlier. That's what people understood them to mean, but that's not what they meant. What they meant is this is equivalent to what, to the spiritual value of doing 14 days of penance here on earth, or doing 500 days of penance here on earth. How that gets applied to souls in purgatory is something we have to leave to God, because the earthly church does not have authority over the church in purgatory. We have to leave that to God. We apply things like indulgences to the holy souls in purgatory by way of prayer. So that's why the church removed those days. These days, all indulgences are either partial, which means the effect is going to be proportional to the devotion with which you do the indulgence, or their plenary. But if you want to think purgatory is a special place and that time exists there, absolutely you can believe that. The church is, you can even believe, like some of the medievals did, that there's physical fire there. Now that the church has definitely moved away from that understanding of, you know, physical fire affecting non-physical souls, but it hadn't condemned it. So you can have a very traditional understanding of purgatory, but you can also have an understanding of purgatory that is more flexible than that.
Renee, I'm going to leave it there because, as I said, everybody called now. So I'm going to try to get some more on. Robert's in Pennsylvania. Robert, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. I have a question regarding some of the statements that Jesus has made regarding the Father. He said repeatedly that he and the Father are one, okay? And also, he said that everything that the Father knows, he knows, basically. Why then, when Jesus is asked about the end times, he doesn't know? He said only the Father knows. He does not know. Why would
okay.
that be?
So the first thing to say is he's not being asked about the end times. In fact, this gets directly into the subject of the talk that I'm going to be giving this Saturday at the Catholic Answers Conference. People misunderstand. It's about Jesus's most famous, most misunderstood prophecy, which is the Olivet Discourse that he gives on the Mount of Olives, which is where this statement occurs. And people think the Olivet Discourse is about the end of the world. And spoiler warning, but it ain't. It is about the destruction of the temple, which we know happened in AD 70. And Jesus says that it'll happen within a generation, which it did. But he says, as to the specific day and hour, that's something the Father knows, but the angels don't know it, and not even the Son knows it. Well, obviously, since the Son is both God and man, that presents us with the answer to our question. In his divine intellect, Jesus is omniscient, and therefore in his divine intellect, he did know it. But in his human intellect, he said, I didn't. And so this is something that's discussed in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. I'm also going to discuss it in my talk. But in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it said that Jesus, in his human intellect, had the fullness of the plans that he had come to reveal. But what he admitted to not knowing, he elsewhere indicated he had not been sent to reveal it. So it's like he had a download from his divine intellect of, here's all the stuff that you're going to reveal. But it didn't include stuff he wasn't going to reveal. And so he wasn't going to reveal the specific day and time that the temple would be destroyed. And so he didn't have that information. And that's why he can say, in his human intellect, that's why he can say the Son doesn't know. And the Catechism, this is like paragraph, I think around 600, but it's in the section on the human knowledge of Christ. And if you look at the footnote to where it says this, it specifically cites Mark 13:32. Which is the passage where Jesus mentions this in Mark's version of the Olivet Discourse.
Robert, thank you. Thanks to everybody who called. As you can hear, that's the music playing, so we are done. Jimmy, thank you for being here with us on a Monday afternoon. Appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And we'll see you at the conference in a few days.
Sounds good.
And that'll do it for us. But as I said, we're going to be here with you all week with new programs each day. So one of them, Thursday, will come to you live from the conference. So that'll do it for us for just for today. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.